Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com. Coming up on this weekend edition, take a look at some of the programming coming up this weekend here on KPCG. A couple of headlines, too. A lot going on out there. And also, taking a look at one of the chapters in the book, Great Again, The Most Dangerous Lie in History. Which lie is that? We'll have details about that and a lot more coming up on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG, and you can listen online too at kpcg.fm and also at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, follow us at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to send in any emails, send those to comments at kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, here with you today. And a lot going on in the news, Grant. I woke up Friday morning, and whenever I wake up and I look at the my phone to check the headlines real quick, I'll usually peruse a few websites. Drudge will be one of them usually, and when they're all in red, then you know that something's going down. UK terror attack on Friday morning. Doesn't appear like it's there's been fatalities, or at least not at this point, but still basically a firebomb on a train, so it caused a lot of chaos and some injuries.
Yeah, you're right. There was a lot of news that took place really recently because my wife was reading a lot of things off her phone to me while I was getting ready this morning. She never does that, but apparently today was pretty special.
All kinds of things. Some of the headlines I have here about the terror attack. Rush hour chaos in London. Passengers run for their lives. Fireball through train. Hair was coming off, which is horrific. Yeah. Woman burned head to toe. 22 hospitalized. And, of course, those numbers always move around a little bit. That's where it is now. Police currently still searching for this knife man that's out there. I'm sure that'll be developing as well. ISIS celebrating. Khan says, that's the mayor over there, I guess, in London. He says, we will not give in to terror. I never understand it when they say those things. Well, terror is not giving in to you either because they keep doing it. I mean, I know it's a nice thing to say, but if you don't stop it, I don't understand what the point is.
He's just giving them the ideal response. That's exactly what they want to hear, someone who's going to make it like a tug of war but not try to wipe them out.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be resilient. I get that, but at the same time, if it doesn't stop... President Trump says time to get nasty, which I'm sure that'll go over well. And then, so anyway, those are some of the stories there, and it'll be, I'm sure, developing over the weekend, but, just a tough situation there. It seems like, I was thinking about this last year, and the UK is really, boy, they've come under quite a few terror attacks. This has not been a good year for them. You consider all the different attacks that have happened, and it seems like at least once a month, sometimes they come quicker than that. It's almost a way of life over there now.
They have to change. Something has to change over there. They're not doing anything really in response to most of these attacks. They just say to keep calm and carry on. What a terrible mindset that is, to act like nothing happened and to just keep on living the same exact way, without ever considering that maybe the way that everyone is living is causing those things.
Yeah, the dream of multiculturalism, it's literally blowing up. It doesn't work. I don't know. I've never seen it work successfully, at least in these modern times here. Here's another story, just kind of interesting. I think people will relate to this. This is from The Guardian. They always do research and reports on people's health and so forth. And poor diet, they say, is a factor in one in five deaths, global disease study reveals. Millions of people are eating the wrong sorts of food for good health, eating a diet that is low in whole grains, fruit, nuts, and seeds, and fish oils, and high in salt raises the risk of an early death, according to the huge and ongoing study, Global Burden of Disease. They say diet is the second highest risk factor for early death after smoking. Other high risks are high blood glucose, which can lead to diabetes, high blood pressure, high body mass index, which is a measure of obesity, and high total cholesterol, and almost all of those are related to what you eat. So, you know, there can be genetic things, I guess, too, but probably not a surprise, but the diets aren't good in the West in particular.
It does seem like diet might be the most important health law, because even some people who rarely ever exercise are doing just fine. In a lot of cases, they might not be peak athletes, but they're doing fine health-wise without too many ailments because simply they're fueling their bodies the right way.
Yeah, so they just keep having this ongoing study. It's interesting, though, because I don't know what's going to come of it. Do they make changes? Are they going to change? You know, obviously it's up to each individual to try to do what you can do, but, you know, I'm talking about these bigger food companies. Are they going to change the way they make food to improve people's health? I don't think that that's happening, or if it is, I'm oblivious to it.
Yeah, I was laughing and shaking my head no while you said that, because that's just kind of the response that is so natural now when you think of a food company reforming its ways to try to help people's health. That's unimaginable at this point.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody last week, and in course of conversation, it came out that they grew up living near a potato chip factory, which is unusual, you know. And maybe it's not unusual, but I've just never thought much of that. But anyway, the point that they made was that it was a horrible smelling, you know, place to be, and it's really turned them off to the idea of eating potato chips. So sorry if you're in the midst of a bowl of chips or something. But I think anytime you're near a big food production plant, it's not a great sensation, and that's where some of the food comes from.
There are a lot of perils to getting too close to the source of the food that we eat now. Knowing too much about how it is prepared is rather disturbing a lot of the time.
So, yeah, I mean, hey, who doesn't like potato chips? But at the same time, yeah, years ago I saw a quote that I always remember, and they said that all potato chips are, and I know there might be some that are healthier, but if you're looking at more of the general chips, they're just a platform for putting salt and fat in your mouth. So I always remember that. I thought that was kind of funny and sad at the same time.
Yeah, they can carry dip on top of them, and then they're like hardened slabs of unhealthiness.
It's just the way they design it, I guess. No matter what the food is, if it's kind of the junk food variety, it seems like you never get full of it.
No.
Like the more you eat, the more you want to eat, and then before you know it, you know, where'd the bag go?
Exactly. It's so easy to polish off a bag pretty quickly.
Yeah, it's very rare. Well, that's the old commercial, right? You can't eat just one. whatever it was. It was maybe it's Pringles or something. No, Doritos. I think it was Doritos. Anyway,
the serving size is like 20 chips. That's so hard to stay under that limit.
Yeah, and that's what's deceiving about it, because you if you look at whether it's a beverage or something you're eating, and it shows you the amounts of things, you can think, oh well, that doesn't seem horrible. But then when you see the serving size, and there's about 20 servings in the bag, but you just ate the whole bag, then it's not as good as it seemed.
No, if you stacked up 20 chips, you'd realize pretty fast you don't want to stop at 20.
No, they're designed to be delicious, or make us think they're delicious anyway. But anyway, that's a study that's ongoing, the global burden of disease. And disease is a burden, no doubt. So anyway, diets is a big factor in all of that. Top story at thetrumpet.com today: a more powerful, more assertive, more terrifying Germany is coming. And this is by Brad McDonald. He's not too far from Germany over there in the UK. This is why the re-election of Angela Merkel actually ought to alarm us. There was a headline the other day where somebody wrote that German election's boring. Politics are boring because Angela Merkel always wins. And, you know, there's not a lot happening over there. But when you look behind the scenes, or you look a little below the surface, you can see actually there's a lot happening in Germany.
Right. And I think I saw a headline. It might have been on the Trumpet, maybe not, about how maybe Germany couldn't survive if they reelected her, which certainly they will. And they always seem like they do every single time she's up for reelection. You know, why do we not think of the possible ramifications for an election if she's maintaining the status quo, and the status quo is so destructive? Why keep reelecting her?
Yeah, there is definitely there is a sentiment of some anger there. I mean, just with when you look at the migrant situation. And, of course, they're not far from the U.K., and they've had their own problems, too, and they see what's happened, some of these terror attacks. And, you know, people don't like that. So at some point it becomes a bigger issue. And so anyway, make sure you check out what's going on there in Germany from this article. A more powerful, more assertive, more terrifying Germany is coming. And then related to that, a strong German leader is imminent. And there's some pretty good ideas about who that may be. So make sure you read that as well. Also mentioning the Trumpet, of course, the Trumpet Hour Weekend Review program this weekend here on KPCG, where some of the Trumpet columnists talk about some of the big trends happening. And that's always good to catch up on that. And then related to trends here, there's a new feature on thetrumpet.com. If you have the Trumpet Brief and you get that sent to you, which you can, it's free, sign up for that. I talked yesterday a little bit about this new feature on the Trumpet website, Trends. So when you go to thetrumpet.com, over in the far right at the top, it says Trends. And you click on it, and what it does is it gives you all the trends from whatever the region may be, Anglo-America, Asia, Europe, Middle East, and you can click on a lot of stories related to those regions. So if you want to really brush up on, say, what's going on in Asia or Europe, and important things as well, and how they tie into Bible prophecy, it puts it all in one spot for you.
Yeah, I really do love that new section. And I got a preview of it a couple of months ago, and it's pretty incredible just to see a major prophecy and pretty much the entire background, the entire projection into the future of that one prophecy, and it's all on one page.
Yeah, so it's nice to have it all put in one spot like that. So that's a new feature there at thetrumpet.com, and check that out if you get a chance here this weekend. Also, there is a new Key of David program. You're going to want to make sure you listen for this or watch this, depending on where you get it from. Fatal Danger in Not Teaching History. In America and Britain today, history is becoming a forgotten subject. History is history. That's what our leaders, it says, show a contempt for history, and our professors ignore it completely. There is a devastating consequences of this grave error. So make sure you do look at that. That's New Key of David this weekend. You can watch it at thetrumpet.com or television if it's on in your local area, and it is in most areas. And then also the audio is here at KPCG. So you can get it three different ways. Trifecta.
Yeah, and that really is a great program because it's sad to think about the number of major universities in this country that don't even require a single history course to graduate 4 years from those universities. If you're systematically eliminating and erasing history like that, you're raising an entire generation of people totally ignorant of the past. That is, again, we've talked about this on the program before, that is a communist strategy, because if you eliminate history, people will much more likely choose communism.
Yeah, and we see people going in that direction and not even really knowing which direction they're going in.
Yeah.
There was a headline the other day that I saw, and I didn't stop to read it, but it was a report. Oh, here it is, yeah. It's from CBS Philadelphia. A new poll out. Nearly 4 in 10 Americans can't name any First Amendment rights. So, which is interesting because a lot of times people are fighting, you know, say, well, we're fighting for our rights, you know, or, you know, they'll start yelling about First Amendment or something. But about 40% can't name any of them. So, and then that, why? It's because, well, that they haven't been taught it in history or in government or looking at the history of the U.S. And so you have a very historically illiterate population, really, and it's easy to kind of manipulate those people and push them kind of into any direction.
Wouldn't it be a lot easier to tolerate ignorance like that if the same people were not out in the streets protesting about it? Like, if you are totally ignorant of a subject, don't open your mouth about it. And that's what we're seeing so often is people, when they're asked a single question about why they're even out there and they're so upset, they can't tell you why.
Yeah, it's an emotional usually reaction of some kind. And of course, there's, I guess, you know, they would say, well, racism or, you know, something, some sort of ism. But they don't know a lot about historyism.
It's like half their vocabulary words end with an ism.
There's too many isms going around and not enough history lessons there. So really, really an interesting program. Make sure you do look at that and over this weekend. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, talked a fair bit today about rise of a European superstate over there. And as Britain moves out of Europe with the Brexit, Europe's ready to move forward pretty aggressively and have centralized government, centralized power, and that should be alarming when you consider what Europe's done with centralized power in the past.
Yeah, with Britain getting out of the way, it's almost like a gigantic blockade to European unification is now removed, because Britain has always been resistant toward that. They have a special remembrance of history because it did affect them very directly. You know, London being bombed by German fighter pilots. They remember what it was like last time Germany was so dominant. And now one of those major obstacles, the nation of Britain, is out of the way.
Right. So make sure you listen for that Trumpet Daily radio show. That actually ties into a historical note we have for today as well. You would have thought we planned that out. We did not. That's on the fly. Two events, both on this day, and they relate to each other. 1938 today, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain visits Hitler at Berchtesgaden, and of course, everyone knows they try to have some peace there, or Neville Chamberlain did, I guess.
Peace in our time.
Peace in our time, but it turned out to not be peace. 2 years later, same day, 1940, the climax of the Battle of Britain, and the tide turns as the Luftwaffe loses 56 aircraft on the day, and then the Royal Air Force lost 28. So it's just interesting. You see, it's the same day, 2 years later, you know, they're talking peace, and you know, I think it'll probably work out, and then 2 years later, they're trying to blow you off the map. It shows how man's peace efforts often end in bombs, usually.
Yeah, and it just shows how easy it is to rip up a contract or to lie about it and go back on your word. If lying didn't exist, then Germany never would have been allowed to attack Britain like they did. So that's just another issue with human nature, how deceptive we can be and how it is kind of easy to hide our true intentions in some of those different dealings.
Yeah, very rarely does it happen where a nation will come out and say, you know, we have like a 10-year plan to take over the world. We're just going to go ahead and let everybody know what our strategy is so you can keep an eye out for it. They're going to lie to you.
Right.
That's what happens. And then they attack. And, of course, people always, you know, Europe always tries to make peace with Russia before they become more militaristic, mm-hmm. because they got to take care of that eastern side, which they don't do very, very effectively ever. And, you know, so there's different things you can look at in history and say, well, whenever you see, say, power being centralized there in Europe, particularly in Germany, what has happened historically? The bad things, right? Why would it be different now?
And history is just a number of patterns that just keep repeating themselves. And the reason they keep repeating themselves is because humans behave the same way. In a lot of cases, we don't learn from those past lessons, and so those lessons just keep coming back around.
Yeah. But some of the details here about the Battle of Britain, just as a refresher, or maybe you don't know much about it. It says both sides lost heavily during the Battle of Britain. More than 1,700 Luftwaffe German Air Force planes were destroyed. The 2,662 German casualties included many experienced aircrew, and the Luftwaffe never fully recovered from the reverse it suffered in the battle between August and October 1940. The Royal Air Force lost 1,250 aircraft, including 1,017 fighters. In all, 520 men were killed serving with fighter command. But with more than 700 fatalities during the period of the battle, Bomber Command suffered even more heavily. Another 200 men were killed flying with Coastal Command. Others suffered some really terrible wounds, burns, and so forth. Men often found themselves enveloped in flames in their cockpits before managing to bail out. Many of these badly burned men ended up in the Plastic and Jaw Injury Center at Queen Victoria Hospital in East Grinstead, Sussex. And so they had to try to deal with them, and many of them were horribly disfigured and nothing much could be done. The Battle of Britain was the first serious setback experienced by the Germans during the Second World War. They thought they were pretty much invincible, and the world kind of believed it too until somebody stood up and fought them. And it gave hope to the conquered Europeans that maybe they could be beaten. The long-term significance was even greater. Britain was preserved as a base for offensive action against Germany. Bombers operating from its bases would devastate German industry and infrastructure later in the war. And so that was important for us to be able to use the U.S. to use to fly those missions in and out of Europe.
Yeah, that really was a a hugely important battle, and also just one that's extremely fascinating to look into, because it was a relentless air attack, and they were decimating large parts of London and maybe other parts of Britain as well. Any other leader besides Winston Churchill, they probably would have given in, and he was just holding them on by a thread. He was going among the crash sites and talking to the affected families and really inspiring them and keeping the morale high despite what was happening.
Yeah, and they knew going in that people are going to die. I mean, their own people were going to die, but that's the price of freedom when you're being attacked. And so, obviously, when they talk about keep calm and carry on, you know, they're harkening back to some of that history. But what would be the difference? Well, the difference would be they were fighting back.
Right.
They weren't just taking it, you know. So when that expression is brought out, it is interesting. It's not, it's being used in the way that it wasn't used originally.
Yeah, they're missing the fire and fury response, like President Trump recently said about North Korea. They need to be responding in a big way about terrorism. And of course, terrorists are so extreme that they probably wouldn't be deterred too much from their actions, but at least they would know that they're going to pay a price for those types of attacks. Right now, it's almost like they feel they can totally get away with it.
Yeah, they kind of can do what they want. And then, you know, if they get caught, I suppose there's punishment. But, yep. And then it'll just be interesting to see how it all unfolds. I think it was mentioned on a Trump Daily program earlier this week, or maybe a little before then, but they had a protest against terrorism, which, you know, I don't know, it's like protesting anything that's obviously bad, but they were protesting terrorism, but a big part of it was like they were chanting no Islamophobia, or, you know, they were so concerned about not offending the group where most of the terrorists come from that was one of their big concerns. And, you know, that would be, if you'd harken back to, say, World War II or something, wouldn't that be like, you know, protesting the war, but, you know, no anti-Nazism? I mean, yeah. Because not every single person that came out of Germany was, you know, just absolutely, you know, a Nazi. But still, what are you going to do? You got to go fight the enemy, right?
Exactly. It is really such a ridiculous line of reasoning we're seeing today. There is a hostile power that really, in a lot of cases, has infiltrated Britain's borders and is carrying out attacks on their own soil. And people won't even acknowledge the enemy. They won't even do anything about the attack itself. They won't even try to form some sort of retaliation. They're more focused on how people's attitudes are after the attack. What kind of good does that do? How does that help anything? How does that stop the next attack from taking place? They're not even concerned about that part of it.
Yeah, if you just look across the headlines, I mean, we're seeing that sort of attitude in the West in a lot of places. You know, like even after the recent hurricane, there's all kinds of stories. I saw one today about, you know, we'll build bigger and stronger than ever. You know, we won't be deterred. And so no matter what the crisis is that the West faces, it seems like the response is, well, we won't be deterred. We'll just keep on doing our thing. Well, but eventually it gets serious enough where you have to stop and maybe pay attention. And of course, the question is there a message in this? Is there something we should be paying attention to? Because if you just say, we'll just deal with it, then maybe, if, you know, God is trying to get a message across, which he is, we're not hearing it.
Yeah, the whole focus after such a tragedy like a terrorist attack or a natural disaster should be on preventing the next one. Of course, you want to save any lives you can after the current disaster, but you have to be looking down the road and thinking about what could you possibly do to stop the next one from taking place. That's not even really a thought right now. That's why they're considering continuing their lives as if nothing had even happened.
Yeah, that would be the victory. You know, you won't deter us from carrying on with our whatever we're doing.
Yeah, so. Sure. Certainly a lot of terrorists are crying because the Britons are living just like they were before.
Right. So it's interesting what's happening over there. But as far as the historical note, 1938, British PM Neville Chamberlain visited Hitler at Berchtesgaden. And then 1940, same day, climax of the Battle of Britain. Tide turns as Luftwaffe loses 56 aircraft. And, of course, if you look at that history, you know, the miracle at Dunkirk, other things like that, God certainly had his hand in preserving the UK and the US. But it doesn't mean it'll always be that way. And, of course, if you look into Bible prophecy, you know that that's not going to happen the next time around because of all the sins we see happening. You know, if we see terror attacks or we see these other things happening, you think you'd stop and say, maybe we should consider the way we're living. And but that no, they do the opposite. We're going to keep carrying on. We're going to keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, perhaps our history of enduring tragedy and coming back stronger from it can be a detriment right now because people tend to credit themselves for our blessings, our relative peace compared to most of the rest of the world, when really we should be thinking about maybe God did it. Maybe it wasn't us who maybe created these blessings for ourselves. Maybe right. It was someone else.
Yeah, there's a great book, United States and Britain in Prophecy, that talks all about that, what's happened in the past, what you can expect to see in the future, and you can get that at thetrumpet.com. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. And again, if you'd like to send us any comments, you can send those to comments at kpcg.fm. We appreciate those. And Grant, we're going to talk about, we've been talking this week about this great book on thetrumpet.com, Great Again, which is talking about some of the things that are happening in the U.S. currently, some of the problems, but ultimately a lot of hope in it because there's good news at the very end. But there are problems that have to be addressed, and the sixth chapter of the book talks about the most dangerous lie in history. That'd be an interesting question for somebody to say, what do you think? What's the most dangerous lie in history? And you'd have to think about it in terms of, because there's been a lot of lies told, right? You'd have to think about it in terms of what type of destruction would that lie bring? And if you're talking about the annihilation of most of the world through nuclear weapons, then the lie we're about to talk about is certainly the most dangerous lie in history.
Exactly. You have to consider the death count. What lie would lead to the most lives lost? And what we're going to talk about certainly is going to lead to that. Prophetically, we know that for sure. There's no doubt about it, that this lie is going to lead to most human life being extinguished.
And it all goes back to, most recently, 2015. The book says this. In 2015, the U.S. spearheaded an international effort to negotiate a nuclear deal with Iran. When the agreement was concluded, many people were elated. But there should have been no celebration. What is at stake is nothing less than human survival. The world needed something that would have pulled us away from the brink of annihilation. But this deal did just the opposite. And so, as is pointed out here, the whole nuclear agreement hinges on the issue of trust. Can you trust Iran? And just some historical information here. Iran has broken its agreements with the United Nations over nuclear inspections around 20 times and counting. They've never done anything to warrant trust from the other side. But yet we said, well, we'll trust them and hope it works out. That is you couldn't take a bigger risk.
Yeah, and technically the deal wasn't even signed by Iran, so we can't consider them faithful to the deal if they haven't even signed it, if they don't even comply with any of the nuclear inspections, if they're continually lying to inspectors about what they're actually doing. It's not a deal they care too much about. Obviously, they love the fact that they were able to plunder the U.S. in that deal. But they know at the same time that the U.S., at least under the last president, was not going to go back on that deal no matter what they did.
Yeah, and they've kind of, slunk away from the main headlines here recently. But because North Korea is causing so much dismay with missile launches, they just launched another one here in the last day or so. But there's concern out of the UK, even some of the experts there saying, how come North Korea has gotten so much more advanced all of a sudden and what they're able to do? And a lot of them think it's because Iran's working with them. So you've got these pariah nations that are working with each other. And, of course, Russia's in the mix, China's in the mix. And they're just causing the West all kinds of problems. And so, what's Iran up to? You just take a look at North Korea, and I think it probably gives us a pretty good idea some of what they're up to.
That's right, and it does seem like both North Korea's and Iran's nuclear programs are much further along than they would be if they weren't helping each other so much. They're able to freely travel back and forth to each other's nations and to inspect what is going on, but also participate in weapons launches, view what is going on in that regard as well. So here we are with two very extreme nations that hate the West, especially America. they're working together, and it doesn't seem like most people are even paying attention to that.
And they've got cash. I mean, they Iran's gotten a lot of cash from the U.S. Pallets of cash, as a matter of fact. And even when they made all these deals and so forth, I think it was John Kerry that admitted, like, well, you know, inevitably they'll probably use some of it for their military, you know, developments. So we've paid them to go ahead and develop weapons, really, if you look at it that way. I mean, it as this chapter points out, like, you can't even come to grips with what they've done, really, unless you start realizing that there's spiritual reasons for these problems. If you just look at it on the physical level, you think, why would you ever do that? Why would you pay your enemy as they sit there and tell you, we want to annihilate you?
Right, and how can we have a leader in this country casually admit that some of the money we sent over to them is going to be used to kill people? And how does he sleep at night knowing that he is a part of that?
Yeah, it's amazing. And it's amazing that the media kind of just chooses to wink at it and not make a bigger deal out of it, because they do make a big deal out of some things. Here's a headline from yesterday from the BBC. President Trump says Iran's atrocious at sticking to the spirit of the nuclear deal. So he's calling them out for not sticking to the spirit of it, and they're not doing anything well in terms of that deal. So at least he's calling them out. I don't know if he'll do anything about it, but he's calling them out on it.
Yeah, that is nice to see that someone will actually say something about what is going on, because we've not heard hardly anything pretty much for a long time because of just the last administration. They were focused on building a legacy off of this deal. They had to make sure that it held up no matter what the circumstances were, no matter how well Iran actually upheld its end of the bargain. It's part of the legacy, so you have to keep it in place. Now we have a president not tied down by legacy, at least in this area of the nuclear deal, so he can say something about it.
Yeah, he's speaking out. The deal, this article says, between Iran, the U.S., and other world powers, including China and Russia, was designed to prevent Iran developing a nuclear weapon. Do you think Russia and China are really all that worried? They're afraid of being nuked by Iran?
No.
I tend to think they're not that concerned.
They're buds. Why would they nuke their friends?
They have a mutual enemy in the United States and Israel and the U.K. The article says, but Mr. Trump has been a frequent critic and on Thursday again called it one of the worst deals I've seen. It's probably the worst deal ever. And he's just looking at it probably from like a monetary and security level. And like what the man does do a lot of deals. He has done a lot of deals. And as he says, this is one of the worst deals you've seen. I don't think that's hyperbole. I think that's actually an understatement. It's probably the worst deal ever.
Yeah, I think we have used some very strong statements at thetrumpet.com about it. I think we called it the worst foreign policy blunder in American history as well. And, you know, the most dangerous lie in all of history. It's a big deal what they did there. And this chapter in Great Again also just brings about how much lying, how much deception went into it, and how much lawbreaking they had to engage in to make this deal possible. The whole thing through and through is despicable.
Yeah, if it was such a great deal, you think they'd brag about it and be honest about it. When have you ever seen a politician not take credit for something that went well? You've never seen them be like, well, you know, the economy's doing better, but let's not talk. Let's keep that quiet. you're going to brag about it. And so to have to cover up these deals, well, you know, why? This article from BBC continues and says, President Trump's words came as the U.S. imposed fresh sanctions on people accused of supporting Iranian cyber attacks. That'd be everybody in Iran, I think. Mr. Trump said, certainly at a minimum, the spirit of the deal is atrociously kept. That's an oddly phrased way to say that, but yes, he's right. On Monday, the International Atomic Energy Agency said Iran was implementing the nuclear-related commitments. Oh, okay. right. But speaking in London, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson cited the preface of the deal, which calls on Iran to contribute positively to regional security. I mean, the fact that that's written into the deal is insanity at the highest level. Take the biggest terrorist sponsoring nation and then say, hey, could you help stabilize the region? Like, yeah, sure, we'll just take over. We'll stabilize it.
Well, isn't the International Atomic Energy Agency also tied to the United Nations, which is far more hostile to Israel and America than it is to Iran, even. I mean, they're always drafting attacks against Israel as if it is the chief evil in the entire world, and yet they do tend to come down on the side of Iran and North Korea and Russia and China and Syria. They always are choosing these hostile powers to support. So, of course, their energy agency is also going to say that Iran is complying with the deal.
Yeah, their comments, I think, are not worth the paper they're probably printed on. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said, in our view, Iran is clearly in default of these expectations to stabilize the region. Through their actions to prop up the Assad regime in Syria, to engage in malicious activities in the region, including cyber activities, aggressively developing ballistic missiles. For what? What are they going to put on the missiles? Cotton candy? I mean, on one hand, they're saying, oh, we're not going to develop nuclear weapons, but they're developing missiles? I mean, you'd have to be a child. And a very young child to be duped by this. It's amazing.
Yeah, I don't even know if a child would be fooled by it, honestly, because it is so rudimentary and it's such an obvious lie that really anyone should be able to figure it out, especially when Iran is always saying that they just want that for energy capabilities.
Right.
They want to develop nuclear power for just for energy, just to sustain the country, not to destroy the entire world. Well, you're building things that are going to hold missiles on top of them. So really what you're saying is just a complete farce.
They're going to create energy, all right? They're going to carry it on missiles to other people. I mean, it's crazy. This book, Great Again, Mr. Fleury writes, for many months before the deal was made, a key member of Obama's inner circle was working hard to lay people's fears to rest. At a meeting with Democratic Party activists in 2014, Benjamin Rhodes, you probably remember that name, then Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communication, argued that a nuclear agreement with Tehran was the best opportunity we've had to resolve the Iranian nuclear issue. He said this deal was probably the biggest thing President Obama will do in his second term on foreign policy.
See, it's a legacy issue.
Yeah.
It's all about it looking good no matter what the facts are underneath the surface.
Yeah, it'll be a legacy, all right. People will remember, I'm sure, at some point. It says, unaware that the meeting was recorded, Rhodes confided to his guests that President Obama was planning to sideline Congress. He said, we're already kind of thinking through how do we structure a deal so we don't necessarily require legislative action right away.
Hmm.
I mean, you want to talk about you know, deception and all these types of things that they like to talk about in the media these days, I guess, in relation to maybe, say, the current administration. This is just flat-out lying, and everybody knows it. On the highest level, security issues in America, and yet there's nothing happens. Everyone just kind of looks at it and goes, okay.
Well, Ben Rhodes is a highly dishonest person. He is, really, he's a fiction writer, but he had a high role in the administration, and he was so insulting of a lot of people that it also goes down, and it's talking about here in this chapter how the reporters that they talk to are on average only 27 years old. Their only reporting experience consists of being around political campaigns. And then this is what he said. They literally know nothing. Then think about the way the media treated that administration, even though the administration had complete disdain for the journalists' abilities. The journalists still fawned all over them as if they were the greatest administration ever, despite getting no respect at all.
Yeah, and that was Ben Rhodes talked about that in a New York Times Magazine interview, and it's interesting too. You're talking about just the media treatment of those things. Just reading some different books about the media and such lately, they talk about that time period, and like everybody in the media knew that they were gonna fall all over that administration. Like, it wasn't a secret. Everybody just kind of knew, like, well, that's what happens. And there was a few, you know, that maybe didn't as much, and they were on the outside. But everyone knew it, and it's not like it was a secret. Or, I mean, you look at the coverage and the way things unfolded during that time in that administration. It's like people just, whatever journalistic honor a person might have, that was gone. It was just to write. It was like writing for a teen magazine about like a boy band. I mean, seriously, that's what it was like. To where, you know, you just write these glowing reviews of everything, and then here Ben Rhodes comes out and tells the New York Times magazine that we lied to everybody, we played them, and he's bragging about it
and laughing about it,
and no one was upset.
Well, look at the way the media is now and how they're going to war against this administration. They've finally woken up after an 8-year slumber, and they think it's worth attacking the administration today. What about the administration that openly insulted your abilities for 8 years, and constantly, every time you didn't give them 100% support, they were throwing you under the bus and saying you need to report better? That's what the last administration did, and they never gave out factual information that the reporters requested. They were always trying to keep things undercover every chance they got. Why were the reporters not more frustrated with the last administration and all the lies that were clearly being told right to their faces? They didn't even say anything about it, hardly.
Yeah, and that's why I think you could have never pushed a deal like this with Iran at any other time. Yeah. Because people would have said, wait, what are you doing? Like, they would have reported on it, but I suppose from the administration standpoint, they looked at the media and they knew they could do whatever they wanted. They could lie and they wouldn't be held to account. And if they were, they'd say, oh, that's just crazy, you know, right wing talk. And so they pushed it through. And I think really, the people, I mean, everybody's responsible, as this book points out, when things like this happen. But the media is very responsible, too. Their job was to at least be the watchdog, and they went to sleep.
Well, journalistic integrity is dead now. And a big reason for that, Ben Rhodes even said, if you're talking to reporters that are only an average of 27 years old, they've only recently come out of college. They've been completely indoctrinated because that's the way the educational system is now. They've been reared for 4 years at least on far left ideologies. So now they're going to stick to their ideology no matter what the facts are. They're totally committed to the Democratic Party. It's probably well over 90% of all media members are Democrats. And they're going to support their side regardless of what the facts are.
Yeah, well, and the companies they're working for, they know what the leaning is. So you're gonna, if you care about your career, which I'm sure they do, then they're gonna report that way. Great again points out that here's what Charles Krauthammer said about the nuclear deal. He said, I think the real issue here is not the fact that we did the ransom, which is a whole other issue. Because I think people know that we do it in a lot of disguised ways. It's that they lied, and they lie shamelessly, and they lie when the lie is uncovered. That's what is so scary, and they lie about the entire Iran deal. This is the tip of the iceberg. Every item on the Iran deal that we were promised, we would hold the line on X, Y, and Z. We did this, or we are getting inspections. They lied all the way through, and that deal is shot through with denials, with all kinds of statements that are not so. And we are going to suffer. That's going to be a lot worse than anything that comes out of this ransom payment. So he was talking about that ransom, that pallet of cash that I sent over there to get some people back. Mm-hmm. But he brings out the point here, and it's a strongly worded thing, but it's the truth. They just lied, and then they get caught lying, just tell another lie, and just lie again.
Well, we truly have never seen anything like it. It's really a level of lying that has never been seen, and quite a few people who had personal interactions with President Obama also said that he was the best liar they've ever come across in their entire lives. And that just shows you the level of deception that is going on there. The amount of times they lied to the American people and to the world, I don't think you could write 10 full books without leaving some of those lies out.
Oh, it's amazing. There's some authors out there that tried to put some of that together. I've read a few of those books, and It's amazing. There's no filler. It's just, you know, I don't know what has 300 pages in each volume, something like that. And it's just like this lie and then this one. And it's amazing when you read through it because you think, I remember that. I remember when that happened. But there's been so many that they get kind of pushed to the back of the queue, as it were. And you forget about them. But you look back and you're like, wow, this was just one lie on top of another.
It really, really was an astounding 8-year presidency, especially the way that they promised to totally change the relationship between the press and the administration during their time in office, because they said they were going to be the most transparent administration in all of history, and they turned out to be the most opaque ever. And that's what a lot of media members even admitted at the end of it, despite their full-on 100% support for that administration. that administration was lying constantly. We've never seen anything like it, and hopefully we never see anything like it again, because a lot of damage has been done during that last 8 years that can never be taken back.
Yeah, it's a really bad situation that's gotten rolling. Gradigan says this: no words will stop this king of terror. We're talking about Iran. You can't talk. It's like going to talk to North Korea. It's not going to do any good. The Iranian leader believes that causing a nuclear cataclysm will hasten the coming of his Messiah. No matter what happens, these religious zealots believe they are winners. No other nuclear power thinks like that. It makes nuclear war inevitable. And that's the extreme danger in this situation. When you're dealing with Russia or some of these other nations, they have the mutually assured destruction, to where, well, nobody wants to be nuked, so you kind of sit there and look at each other. But now you bring in a player like Iran. They're religious zealots, the leadership are, and that's what they believe, and you can see that many places. And so that's their goal, is to bring back their Messiah, their version of that. And so you're not dealing with somebody that you can reason with, even on just a practical sort of level. And that's who we made a deal with, quote unquote.
That's the deadly flaw in our negotiations with them, because we tend to treat them like any other nation when they're not. They're totally, totally different from any other people who we would ever deal with, because mutually assured destruction does not deter them whatsoever. They actually invite that, and they look forward to that, because it means they have an afterlife with a lot of great benefits, they think. They think that's coming if they kill as many people as possible.
Yeah. And it sounds strange to those of us in the West. You think, what? They really believe that? But that is what they do believe. But this really gets down to the point of, okay, so why would we ever make a deal with like this? Well, Great again points out, Mr. Obama's appeasement of and support for the Iranian regime cannot be explained logically. Such a catastrophic policy can only be understood in the context of the satanic deception that blankets this entire world. If that sounds odd, you can look at Revelation 12 and verse 9, where it says that that Satan has deceived the whole world. Those efforts shoved the world closer to the brink of nuclear annihilation, and nothing could please the devil more. That old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world, quoting the Bible there, had his fingerprints all over those developments. He passionately hates mankind and loves causing the death of millions, even billions. So think about that. Revelation 12:9 says that Satan deceives the whole world. How do you explain the media in those last 8 years? Absolute deception, like the wool had just been pulled over their eyes. How else do you explain that?
Right, and now it's like they're the ones perpetrating all the deception that they learned from that administration. They're turning around. They at one time were deceived by the last administration, and now they're actively deceiving the entire world about this administration. It's completely unfair, and yet it's happening. But if you look at this nuclear deal with Iran and just how intricately they crafted this fake story about how somehow making this deal is now acceptable. It started back in 2013, like this chapter describes, where Ben Rhodes basically reinvented the leaders of Iran and said they were all moderates back in 2013. That's what he said, they're moderates, and then he later admitted that he didn't know if any of them were actually moderates. He called them that so the American people would start to warm up to the idea of working with a new regime there.
Well, which, you know, obviously is ridiculous, but Let's assume that was correct, which it's not. So you would want to allow a nation that could go back to being extreme at any time, nuclear weapons, you know, because all right, they have their democracy, right? They have elections and different people get in. Isn't that what they're supposed to be, the democracy of Iran? It's insane, and but yet there wasn't much resistance to it, and so, you know, people just kind of looked at it like, huh, there you go. And now what's Iran up to? That's, you know, they're probably helping North Korea and who knows what else.
Yeah, they're more hostile to us than they were before we even formed this deal, if that were even possible. We thought it would be the opposite, where maybe they would be more friendly toward us. That hasn't happened at all. And this deal, the way it's described by a lot of its proponents, is just total fantasy land. They say it's just totally, it's delaying what Iran was trying to do by 12 or 15 or 20 years, and it's really making it impossible for them to ever effectively create the weapons that they desire. Why are you saying that is the case? You don't have any evidence of that. You're just saying it. You don't have any inspectors who can monitor what they're doing and honestly report back on it. How do you know that you're delaying that whole process?
Yeah. And even if they were, is that okay? Yeah, they'll nuke us, but we got 10 years. I mean, wouldn't you want to root out that threat completely? It's insanity. Great again points this out. This explosive situation will result in nuclear war. It's going to. Jesus Christ prophesied the outcome of these problems in Matthew 24:21-22. He said the coming great tribulation would be worse than any in mankind's long tragic history. And if you go back and look at the history of war, World War II especially, it was very brutal. He warned that unless these perilous days were shortened, no flesh would be saved alive. So that is where it's leading. But there is good news in that, because it does end with Christ returning and putting an end to this type of thing. You know, you don't hear about that. People don't think that's going to happen. You don't see that on the political talk shows. You know, how are we going to solve this? Well, we need Christ to return. You know, you don't hear a lot of that, but that's what he said. That's what he prophesied.
Yeah, it is pretty astounding, too, the deception there, where Satan has made the whole world think that another return maybe isn't likely. You have the Jews who still don't believe that Christ even has come the first time yet, and then at the same time you have most traditional Christianity believing that, well, he's already come and he's in our hearts, and we just need to treat each other well and we'll die and go to heaven when we die, and that's it. There's not really going to be a return. So everyone around the world is deceived about that topic, and yet Christ is going to come. The disasters, the destruction will get a lot worse in the short term, and then it'll all of a sudden improve.
Yeah, and that's the hope in it all. And there is a reality here too, because it's easy to talk about this and just talk about, say, an administration or something. Of course, there's a lot to talk about there, but as this book also points out, the people are responsible for the leader. The people are responsible for the leader that gets in. And it does get back then to the individual. You know, you could say, well, what, the Iran deal's got nothing to do with me personally. But, you know, if we're not living righteously, then we have leaders that lie and deceive, and then we have the results of that. And that's the heart of the problem.
That's right. And the founding fathers even talked about that a lot. What you do in the privacy of your own home doesn't impact the entire nation. If you're not raising a strong family, then those people coming out of your household are not going to be upstanding members of society. And it all breaks down from there. If you have the family wrong at the foundation, then it just branches out into a lot of destructive things. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a moral breakdown on a large scale, and it's happening drastically now. And then, of course, you see the result of that. You see the curse is just multiplying as our nation just slides down morally.
Well, yeah, when you have moral issues, you lose your will to fight because you're losing personal battles. Mm-hmm. And so how could we ever stand up to some sort of a regime? And then, like we touched on earlier, when you know, you have people that just don't know anything about history, as Akia David points out this weekend, you know, they don't care. They're not being taught. The young people aren't being taught. How do they know? You get some guy comes along, a Ben Rhodes, he spins a story for you, and you don't know enough to know whether he's telling you the truth or not, and so you just believe it. And that does come back to the individual person that's raising the child or is teaching in the school or whatever. You know, it shouldn't be that easy to deceive people, but it is.
Right. And if we had the families right, we would not so willingly turn our children over to these institutions that are completely godless and immoral, these universities that are turning our kids into atheists. That's what's going on there. That's the brainwashing that is taking place. If you don't believe in God, that's the whole wrong foundation of life as well. And a lot of these kids come out of college, they don't believe in God anymore. They don't have any sort of foundation for their moral beliefs. And in that case, anything goes. It really is a complex problem, but the root of it is just lawlessness.
And I mean, in a way, you do have to sort of hand it to Iran that on some level, some of those nations, they at least hold to their beliefs better than the mm-hmm. West does. Even though they're wrong beliefs, they at least on some level hold to them. So,
well, they literally do what their book says.
Right.
They put into practice what is in the Quran. In the meantime, over here, we say that the Bible can't be taken literally, and it's a bunch of myths that we can't really trust are true.
Right. But then at the same time, want to be very careful to not disrespect their beliefs. It's so funny. Well, do we have any beliefs? You know, do we have any foundation for beliefs? Great again says, the only solution to our massive problems is repentance toward God. Ezekiel 33:11. God will protect nations or individuals who repent now before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. So there is individual action that can be taken. You know, you can't change the policies of a nation, but certainly there's individual action. And then the seventh chapter, which we don't have time to get into, but that's where it talks about the great hope, incredible hope in your end. What happens after the end of difficulties and problems? Is it the end of mankind forever when nukes go off, or is something else going to happen? There is hope there in that, and that's the thing we don't want to forget about at the end of things.
Right, because in a lot of movies that depict world wars, you don't necessarily see a light at the end of it that shows there's any hope. You just see that a world war would wipe out the world. It does go beyond that, and the whole world will be renewed. It just is a matter of submitting to that, which humans will have to do. We'll have to submit to God's rule, because we have proven we can't rule ourselves.
Yeah, it's an interesting time that we live in, and you just see more and more happening with Iran and some of these other nations and North Korea and so forth. So it's good to know where it's leading. And make sure you get this book, Great Again. It's at thetrumpet.com. Lot to look at there. Just hit some of the highlights today and this week, but it is essential reading right now. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us. And make sure that you listen for the programs that are coming up this weekend, including the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Also, the Key of David program, that's a new one that's coming up as well. And the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program on the way, and more, all this weekend here on KPCG. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.
Listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.